Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Shri Shri Radha Krishna Go Gopina Shai Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan Ki Jai Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai Mathur Dham Ki Jai Navadvip Mayapur Dham Ki Jai Jagannath Jai Gangamai Jamuna Devi Ki Jai Bhakti Devi Ki Jai Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai Samaveda Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Nityanamane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nirvasesa Sunyavadi Paskachade Satarane Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitamstam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Padijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha Panchakalpa, Trubhyascha, Kripa Sindhu Vyogacha, Pachakaman Kavanevyo, Vaishnavevyo, Namo Namaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Bhagavate Vasudevaya. September 28, 2015, Hilo, Hawaii. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 6, Creation of the Universal Form, Text 10. Smaran Vishvas Rajamisho.
Smaran Vishvas
Vignapita Madhoksaja. Virajamata Patsena Tejasai Sam Vivritaye. Remembering.
Remembering.
Vishvasrijam. Of the demigods entrusted with the task of cosmic construction. Ishaha.
Ishaha.
The Supreme Lord.
The Supreme Lord.
Vignapitam.
Vignapitam.
As he was prayed for.
As he was prayed for.
Adhokshajaha.
Adhokshajaha.
The transcendence.
The transcendence.
Virajam.
Virajam.
The gigantic universal form.
Atapat.
Considered thus.
Svena.
By his own.
Tejasa.
Energy.
Esham.
For them.
Vivritaye.
For understanding. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. The Supreme Lord is the supersoul of all the demigods entrusted with the task of constructing the cosmic manifestation. Being thus prayed to by the demigods, he thought to himself and thus manifested the gigantic form for their understanding. Purport. The impersonalists are captivated by the gigantic universal form of the Lord. They think that the control behind this cosmic manifestation is imagination. Intelligent persons, however, can estimate the value of the cause by observing the wonders of the effects. For example, the individual human body does not develop from the womb of the mother independently, but because the living entity, the soul, is within the body. Without the living entity, a material body cannot automatically take shape or develop. When any material object displays development, it must be understood that there is a spiritual soul within the manifestation. The gigantic universe has developed gradually, just as the body of a child develops. The conception that the transcendence enters within the universe is therefore logical. As the materialist cannot find the soul and the supersoul within the heart, similarly, for want of sufficient knowledge, they cannot see that the supreme soul is the cause of the universe. The Lord is therefore described in the Vedic language as Avan Manasa Gorchaha, beyond the conception of words and mind. Due to a poor fund of knowledge, the mental speculators try to bring the supreme within the purview of words and mind. But the Lord refuses to be so intelligible. The speculator has no adequate words or mind to gauge the infinity of the Lord. The Lord is called the Hoksaja, or the person who is beyond perception by the blunt, limited potency of our senses. One cannot perceive the transcendental name or form of the Lord by mental speculation. The mundane PhDs are completely unable to speculate on the Supreme with their limited senses. Such attempts by the puffed-up PhDs are compared to the philosophy of the frog in the well. A frog in a well was informed of the gigantic Pacific Ocean, and he began to puff himself up in order to understand or measure the length and breadth of the Pacific Ocean. Ultimately, the frog burst and died. The title PhD can also be interpreted as plow department, a title meant for the tillers of the paddy field. The attempt of the tillers in the paddy field to understand the cosmic manifestation and the cause behind such wonderful work can be compared to the endeavor of the frog in the well to calculate the measurement of the Pacific Ocean. The Lord can reveal himself only to a person who is submissive and who engages in his transcendental loving service. The demigods controlling the elements and ingredients of universal affairs prayed to the Lord for guidance, and thus he manifested his gigantic form, as he did at the request of Arjuna. Smaran Vishvas Rajamisho Vigna Pitam Adhoksha Jaha Virajam Atapat Svena Tenai Tejasai Sam Vivritaye. The Supreme Lord is the supersoul of all the demigods entrusted with the task of constructing the cosmic manifestation. Being thus prayed to by the demigods, he thought to himself and thus manifested the gigantic form for their understanding. So this verse answers the question, why are we here? How did it all get here? And how do we figure it out? Right? What am I doing here? How did I get here? How did this world get here? Why is it here? You know, all of a sudden, here we find ourselves, right? We find ourselves in the womb and born, and we're in a particular family and country and so forth and so on. And like, how did I get here? It's one of the main questions that the child asks the parents. Right? Where did I come from? Why am I all of a sudden here? What's my origin? Where did the world come from? How did it get here? And, you know, materialists, as Krishna explains in the 16th chapter, they have only a material explanation. When the child asks, how did I get here? The parents think, oh, wait, we have to tell them about sex. Right? And if they say, how did the universe get here? They think, oh, we've got to talk about the Big Bang. And Prabhupada says in the purport that just as the materialists are unaware that they and the supersoul are within their own body, so similarly they are unaware of the Lord within the universal body. So why is there anything? Prabhupada was asked this question in South America. Why is there anything? Why does anything exist? And Prabhupada at that time answered for ananda, for pleasure. Here we see the words smaram and vignapitam. So the Lord is remembering. And the Lord is remembering the specific prayers of the demigods. Now often we talk about remembering as an anga of bhakti, as something that we, the living entity, are supposed to do about the Lord. That we're supposed to remember the Lord as he desires us. So Krishna here, he's remembering how the demigods desire him. He's remembering what the demigods desire. Oh yes, the demigods want me to manifest the details of the universe. The work isn't finished. I have to finish the work. Just like if somebody's doing some job and they stop in the middle and they get involved in something else, and you remind them, oh, could you please finish this work? The job is not done. And could you finish it like this and like this? So generally we think about our doing this for the Lord, that we remember, oh, Krishna gives this instruction, sarva dharma pritya man mana bhavabad bhakto. Krishna gives this instruction and I've forgotten about it. I haven't been following it, or I'm not following it completely. Oh yes, I have to remember this and follow his instruction. But Krishna is doing this, the Lord is doing this, or here's Lord Vishnu, is doing this same process for his devotees, and here for the demigods, who are primarily sakkama devotees. What to speak of how he does this for the nishkama devotees. So he's remembering, he's thinking of his devotees, he's thinking of his servants, and what they want. Clearly he's also thinking of all the jivas, who have their various material desires, what they were remembering, yam yam bhavi smram bhavam. He's thinking about that. He's remembering, oh yes, they have these particular desires. The Lord is a wish-fulfilling tree. We say this about the devotees, right? Vanchakalpa chubhishtha kripa sindhubhyeva chapatitanam pavaneva vaishnaveva namo namah. So we say the devotees are like desire-fulfilling trees. What to speak of the Lord? Right? The Lord is nityanityanam chaitanyachaitanyanam eko bahunam yo vidadati kama. So the one living entity has been fulfilling the desires of all of these subordinate living entities from the beginning of time. And as it says in the Isha Upanishad, he's a self-sufficient philosopher who's fulfilling everyone's desires. So the why is Krishna's remembering and Krishna's responding to specific desires. You could say that he's like a very indulgent parent who gives his sons and daughters, who gives his children, his expansions, whatever they want. Now, of course, although he gives the jivas whatever they want, if they want something that's opposed to his own desires, then they have to work for it independently under his laws. So if they want something that's in harmony with his desires, then he fulfills that within his own home, so to speak. Right, if the teenager wants something that the parents also want, then the parents can supply that within the home. If the teenagers want something that's opposed to the parents, then they say, well, you can't stay here. You'll have to be someplace else. You know, they may give that person the tools, they may give the child the tools through education and so forth to fulfill desires opposed to them, but it's not within the home. So Krishna is very indulgent like that. However, if one desires things that are opposed to him, there's a separate place. There's the material world. And the creation, the why of this creation, is really the great kindness of the Lord. We can say that he has no obligation. He's not... We may be have some sort of obligation for those who are in harmony with us, and who serve us to reciprocate their service, gratitude. One of the items, the 14 items of knowledge, is gratitude. And the Mahabharata states that there's no worse sinner than an ingrate. So Krishna is very grateful. It's one of his own qualities. Naturally, he's going to be grateful to those who are totally surrendered to him and who are giving him everything. But why would Krishna have any gratitude or obligation or moral? There's nothing on any level of duty or love or on any level that Krishna would need to fulfill the desires of the rebellious souls. The rebellious souls' desires are intrinsically selfish and, dare we say, evil. Even at the highest level, as Srila Prabhupada sometimes says, whether you steal a diamond or a cucumber, you're still a thief. So from the Yastinda Gopamatavendra Mahoswakarma Bandhani Rupa Palabhajana Mantanoti, whether you're the tiniest little germ, you know, only can be seen under a microscope, lives for a few hours, or whether you're the great Indra or the great Brahma, still we're all in rebellion. We all are motivated by evil desires, whether those are in ignorance, passion, or goodness. They're all essentially selfish. So why would Krishna care to fulfill evil desires? Because he has love. He has love. And if he doesn't fulfill those evil desires, then what would he do? What would be the alternative to the creation of the material world? In fact, Krishna does put us in a state of suspended animation for the same length of time as the creation exists. He does put us in a state of unconsciousness and inactivity within the body of Mahavishnu. But again, he's compassionate, and again he manifests the creation, and again he becomes disgusted, as explained in the fifth canto, with the glories of Ananta, and then he withdraws the whole creation. Because this creation exists not only out of love for the living entities to give them a chance to fulfill their nasty desires, but it also exists out of love that the Lord is remembering. Now we have this word smaran here. The Lord is remembering that we are actually his parts and parcels, Jivarasvara Paya Krishna and Nityadasha, that we are really his devotees. And he wants to give us a chance for reform. And it's only the most evil, hateful person who says, all right, you have no chance ever for reform. A human beings love stories of redemption. If you study the literature and media, one of the most loved storylines is that of redemption, the redeemed reprobate. Right? And such stories are common throughout our scriptures as well. The redemption, we've just been studying about Vamandev, how Bali Maharaj turns from the enemy of Indra to a great devotee of the Lord. Of course, we have Jagai and Madhai in recent times. But throughout the scriptures, we find this fall and redemption, fall and redemption, fall and redemption. And the Lord also enjoys giving the living entities the facility for their redemption, the facility for them to come to their original position as souls. So this is all the Lord's remembrance and reciprocating with the desires of the living entities in general, and here his specific servants, the demigods in particular. Therefore, we can understand that the process that we are given, it's also being done by the Lord. That our process of reciprocating with his desires, understanding his desires, molding ourselves according to his desires, remembering them. This is what the Lord is doing. This is why the world exists at all. Then how does the world exist? So this purport, this verse in purport, explain not only the why, but also the how. So we've talked about this before. The entering of spirit, and then the gradual expansion of matter because of the entering of spirit. And Prabhupada said the universe gradually unfolds, just like the child in the womb goes from one microscopic cell to, you know, a 7-pound, however many kilograms that is, baby. And then the baby is born, and the baby is growing, and a full-grown adult, gradually coming to full power. And then, of course, gradually dwindling. And Prabhupada says, anything that does this, there must be spirit. Spirit must have entered. We don't see this sort of effect in things where there is no entrance of spirit. Now, if you just put down a rock, the rock doesn't expand. You don't put down a pebble and it becomes a rock. Material things don't do that. I mean, it would be a little odd, wouldn't it? You know, you buy a chair and the next day it's bigger and so forth and so on. So there's a very funny traditional story about a man who was stealing spoons. Right? And the person from whom the spoons were stolen talked about how his spoons were having babies. Right? And he said, the thief said, that's not possible. And he said, well, if it's not possible for my spoons to have babies, it's not possible for them to die either. You know, there must be a thief. So we don't find that with material things, they don't grow, they don't reproduce, they simply dwindle. They don't do anything else but dwindle. They simply fall apart, rust and mold and just general degeneration. One of the kids here has a bicycle in the back they haven't used, and vines are growing on it. And if they continue not to use it, pretty soon it will simply rust into oblivion. It will again become earth. So the material things are like that. This is a very simple distinction between matter and spirit. So this matter gets enlivened by spirit. Matter gets enlivened by spirit. Spirit is the enlivening force. And then there's a gradual unfolding. We see that within our own spiritual awakening, that it is generally a gradual unfolding. You know, there are some instances of persons who attained full enlightenment in a moment. It's certainly possible. King Prataparudra's son was such a person. But generally speaking, our spiritual life unfolds gradually. Haridas Thakur compared it to the sunrise, where we awaken from sleep, usually gradually. If you awaken too fast, and then it's a disturbance. One of my former Gurukul students was sleeping in the middle of the day. She was taking a little nap. And when the phone rang, she jumped out of bed to answer the phone, became dizzy, fell on her face, and broke her nose. So generally, awakening is done gradually. So the creation unfolds gradually on a microcosmic scale in terms of our individual bodies. The whole creation unfolds gradually. And our inner consciousness also unfolds gradually, like the sun rising or like a flower blooming. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu spoke to, I think it was Sanatana Goswami, about the creeper, the bhakti lata. So it starts with the seed. Of course, the seed of bhakti is already within our hearts, as Rupa Goswami and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explained. It's not gotten from another source. It's already there. So when we say the guru plants the seed, he's planting a seed that's already there in the heart. He's taking a seed that's already there, and he's starting the germination. You know, if I go to your home and you already have a packet of seeds and I plant them, and then the seeds are yours. So he's planting this seed of bhakti, and it's growing and growing, and then it pierces the shell of the universe like Vamandev's foot. Padanakanira Janucha Janapavana. So it pierces the shell of the universe, and it goes all the way to Goloka Vrindavan, where it starts to manifest a bud, and then a flower, and then finally a fruit of love of God that's offered to the lotus feet of the Lord. So this spirituality is compared like this to the gradual unfolding of a plant. Here in our garden, we see this. Right? We plant a seed, and there's first the seed is very delicate. Unless the soil is airy, loose, the seed will not grow. And we were studying with one of the little children about oxen plowing the land. Why is there a plow? To loosen the soil. So the little seed growing and the tiny, delicate little root and stem that come out, the first embryonic leaves that aren't even real leaves that fall off, and the need for sunlight and water and so forth. So Srila Prabhupada also, he says, initiation, it's like planting the seed, but then you have to water it. Planting the seed, your business is not finished. And the seed should be planted in fertile soil. Fertile soil. So generally one has to do some sukriti, or else the seed cannot even germinate. And Jesus talks about this analogy. And we see practically that when we teach about Krishna consciousness to people, if their soil is rock hard, then even if we try to plant their own seed in their heart, it can't germinate, it can't even go into the soil. So the soil has to be soft and airy, and then there has to be a deliberate attempt at water and sunshine, fertilizer, and so forth and so on. And then the plant very gradually develops, and it's in its initial stages, it's very delicate. Srila Prabhupada writes in the Bhagavad Gita that one needs a lot of superior guidance on this path of bhakti, especially in the beginning. A very strong, mature plant doesn't have the same kind of need, and therefore we see the Vedic system, the system of ashram, was that children stayed at the home of the guru. And there they received a lot of instruction. They had a lot of protection. They had a lot of instruction. They were taught how to control their senses, how to work for the pleasure of the Lord. They were very much protected. And then when they reached mature age, then they were able to go on to become, as it says in the seventh canto, grahasthas, vanaprasthas, or sannyasis, and some of them would stay A few would stay as lifetime students, but most would go on to the Grihastha Ashram, and some would go on directly to the Vanaprastha or the Sannyas Ashram, where then they have internalized the instructions of the Guru. It's become part of them. They're never independent from Guru, but that staying in the home of the Guru with the constant supervision is no longer required because they are strong and healthy. So this is the gradual unfoldment of spirit on every level, whether it's the gradual unfoldment of spirit in terms of the growth of the material body, or whether it's the gradual unfoldment of spiritual consciousness. So how do we know all these things? How do we know? I mean, the Shastra says this, but so many people can say so many things. How do we know that this is actually what is true? Well, Srila Prabhupada talks about, interestingly enough, sort of opposite things here. He says here, the gigantic universe has developed gradually, just as the body of a child develops. The conception that the transcendence enters within the universe is therefore logical. So Srila Prabhupada says, this is logical. It's something you can understand if you apply Pratyaksha Anuman, if you apply your senses and logic. There's a number of other places also where Srila Prabhupada will say that even without any education, a person just using their senses and logic can understand there must be a soul and there must be God. And indeed, many times, I can't really do this over Skype, but many, many times, face-to-face with an audience, we'll have a discussion about how do we know that there's a God, just using our senses and logic, not using nothing from Shastra, nothing from Revelation. How can one understand that I must be a soul? I must be a soul within a body, and there must be the supreme soul, God, within the universal body. There must be a creator and maintainer. And we get pretty consistent answers, transnational, transcultural, about the obvious and logical existence of the soul and the existence of God without any need of consulting with scripture. The 11th canto gives many gurus. The 11 gurus are listed, I think it's 11. And these are things like, you know, some girls' bangles and, you know, ordinary things in the world, that just by looking at ordinary things in the world, one can understand so much about reality. And then later on in the purport, Srila Prabhupada says that even if you're the most educated person, even if you have a PhD, you have the limit of material education, you're still not going to be able to understand God. So first he says it's just simply logical, which relates, he doesn't say that specifically here, but in many places he'll say anyone can understand. Any child can understand that I am not this body, that there must be a God. It's just a logical, rational, obvious thing. And then he says that even with the greatest amount of education, you cannot understand. So how do we put those together? That with no education, it's possible to understand, and yet you can't understand with any amount of education. So we can sort of bring together these two seemingly contradictory points in a number of ways. The first is that there's a limit on understanding through Pratyaksha Anuman. One can understand I'm not this body and there's a God without any education at all. And certainly with greater education, one can understand more. Just like Prabhupada wanted Bhakti Swarupadamodara Maharaj to write a book, which he did, about the scientific basis of Krishna consciousness. So if you go deeper into education, if you have more education, you can explain in more detail how God exists. And Bhakti Swarupadamodara Maharaj, he was explaining about something about carrots. I haven't read the book for a long time. And the color of carrots, and we can see the hand of a creator. There's a scientist, not a devotee, called Michael Bebe, who wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box. And there he gave many examples from science and medicine about how there must be a God. So certainly, as one gets higher and higher in mundane intelligence, one can give more and more expert and detailed and intellectual proofs for the existence of God. But even then, there's a limit. There's no way that no matter how much education one has, that one could demand that God appears before them. As Prabhupada says, you can know the cause by observing the wonder of the effects. Right? He says that right in the beginning. Intelligent persons can estimate the value of the cause by observing the wonder of the effects. Right? He says, intelligent persons. So one could imagine then that Prabhupada's talking about people who are educated and so forth, that by observing the creation, by observing their own body, they can have some estimate of the cause. But you can only estimate. You can't go beyond that. There's a limit, and Prabhupada gives his example here of the frog, that if the frog tries to imagine a Pacific Ocean and all the frog knows is a well, then the frog will think of the Pacific Ocean in relation to their own well. And there's a limit. The frog will say 3 times as big, 10 times as big. So regardless of one's education and learning on the material level, one can only understand the self and God to a certain extent. When one reaches a ceiling, you know, who could understand that God is a blackish, bluish cowherd boy sporting, you know, with the gopis and the gopas and cows? I mean, that's beyond anything that anyone can understand just through observing the material world, just through using their senses and logic. When one reaches a limit there, and particularly Prabhupada's condemning here, as he often does, people who think that they don't need the grace of God, that they're going to understand everything about the world, the whys and the hows, without any grace, without any reciprocation from the creator and the maintainer. And really, such a conclusion is absurd even from the platform of Pratyakshan Anuman. From the platform of Pratyakshan Anuman, you cannot understand everything without that person's direct intervention. Just like archaeologists, and they dig up stuff from ancient civilizations and they try to understand that civilization. But unless they get a description of the civilization from the civilization itself, there's a ceiling of knowledge. You know, what they really look for are not so much artifacts, but what they really look for is something in language. Now, they look for something written where the civilization will be describing itself. And that's going to be their main key to understanding that civilization. The same is true with anything. Right? I have some artwork here on my walls, and of course I can understand something about the artist from looking at the artwork. But there's a limit as to how much I can understand by looking at the artwork. I would have to get the grace of the artist or someone who knows the artist in order to have any kind of detail. And here it's explained, the Lord is showing the universal form to the demigods just as he showed that universal form to Arjuna. So that's also revelation, as Krishna tells Arjuna, I need to give you the eyes of the demigods. I need to give you celestial eyes to see this form. So, you know, I look out in the night sky, in the daytime sky, and all around me, and I can hear that the trees are the hairs of the Lord, and the clouds are his head hair, and his eyes are the day and the night, the sun and the moon are his eyes. I can hear that, but I don't really experience it. My experience is a tree, here's a mountain. I don't experience the mountains as the bones of a great form. I don't perceive that great form directly. I can meditate on it, but I don't perceive it. And I would only perceive it if the Lord reveals it to me, if he allows me to perceive it. So in this way, often the most intelligent persons, Maya Paritta Jnana, are the biggest fools. Because the beginning of all knowledge is humility. And often the highly educated persons are the least likely to understand. Because they're so enamored by their own intelligence and they're so enamored by their own learning that they don't realize that there's a limit to it. Now, of course, if they're really intelligent, they would know that as you progress through education, you know more and more about less and less. So a PhD means you amass a tremendous amount of knowledge about one very, very small area. And it's generally an extremely small area. You become the world expert in that teeny tiny area. And you know very little about anything else. You know, just because you're a rocket scientist doesn't mean you understand the stock market, for example, or your brain surgeon doesn't mean you know how to grow corn. It, you know, it's anybody with a tiny, tiny bit of perception would know that just because you have a tremendous amount of learning and intelligence doesn't give you the ability to contact the whole. And even us devotees, we have to be careful that we don't try to force the Lord and the Shastra and the Holy Name, etc., to reveal themselves to us. That we don't think by the force of my practice, by the force of my intelligence, I can control this. I can control the Holy Name by my technique of chanting. You know, I can control the scriptures by my hermeneutics. I can control the Lord. I can put the Lord out. Of course, the Lord does come under the control of the devotee. And that is just like the parent comes under the control of the little child voluntarily. Voluntarily. That is not by force. Prabhupada gave the example of this British diplomat or politician, big politician, prime minister or something, who kept some dignitary waiting because he was giving a horseyback ride to his grandson. So that's out of affection. It's not that the grandson, the little, you know, 2 or 3 year old child, is actually controlling the prime minister. So this mentality that I can control Krishna, I can control the process of devotion, I can force the gradual unfolding of spirit to obey my commands. You know, just like in modern agriculture, they try to force the plants to bear quickly and in all sorts of forms that are resistant to disease and stuff. And their forcing simply destroys the nutrition. Right? When they grow their crops with pesticides and herbicides and artificial fertilizers and so forth, and the forms don't have as much nutrition as the forms that where one works with nature. What to speak of what they're doing to the animals that they slaughter, where, you know, well, the chicken takes too long to grow, so we're going to pump them up with female hormones, and then we're going to have to pump them up with antibiotics and so many things. And this way we'll be able to have a chicken ready for slaughter in half the time. And so this is not the way to approach the spirit. Not with forcing. Force is the antithesis of spirit. Spirit is voluntary and loving. Spirit is requesting, not demanding. Spirit is being the servant, not trying to be the master. With the confidence that everything is done by Krishna reciprocating with the desires of the jiva. That Krishna is reciprocating with our desires. He wants to please us. He has created this whole material world. Maintains this whole material world simply to please us. Well, why would he not want to please us in our spiritual desires if he's pleasing us in our material desires, which bring us nothing but regret and foolishness? Why would he not facilitate our spiritual desires? He wants to show himself to us. Prabhupada would often say, Krishna wants to talk to you more than you want to talk to him. He wants to reveal himself. He wants to be seen by us. But he's not going to be seen by us if our mood is wrong. He's not going to come if we try to force him, whether with our big brain or our muscles or our Shastra quotes or our strict following. You know, none of those things are going to force him to come. But rather it's a question of submission and love. That's how the Lord's creating. The Lord's creating, again, with this smaranam. He's creating with remembrance and love, with care, because he cares, not because he's forced. And in the same way, we are enjoined. Actually, we have his qualities. We are enjoined to access those spiritual qualities which we have and deal with him in the way that he is dealing with us. He's dealing with us in a very loving, giving, compassionate way, remembering us, and we should deal with him in that way also, not by force or by pride. So, questions, comments?
A little bit of a cliffhanger there in your talk. You were mentioning that in your live classes that you would, in a very interactive way, ask your listeners how they practically perceive God without Shastric quotes, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And you said that there was sort of a trans-cultural common answers that you got, but you didn't give us any.
Oh.
Kind of curious what they were.
I see. Well, the kind of answers people give is that God must be very artistic. He must be very orderly. At the same time, he must be full of surprises, because although there's general order, there's also surprises. He must really like individuality. You get those sort of things, just from observing the natural world. Must be very intelligent, those sort of things. I mean, it's really, if you want to do this sort of experiment yourself, just sit down with, you know, one or more friends and make a list of what you can know about God just by projection anuman, just by observing your life in the natural world. And what do you come up with? I mean, there's sometimes people come up with something a little unique, but it's generally a rather similar overlapping list, no matter who you ask, because the natural world is also our mother and is also a type of guru and teacher for us, and also reveals to some extent, just in her bearing and her manifestation, something of the Father.
Nice, thank you. Yeah, sometimes I'm sure we've all done it. You pluck a flower out from the ground that's just come out of earth or just come out of sand, and it's so beautiful and so scented. And we're often thinking, how can there not be a God? I remember the other day we were driving along, and alongside the road was a peacock, a beautiful male peacock dancing. And we stopped and just watching this beautiful, beautiful creature. I mean, how can this just happen by accident? God has got to be the most incredible artist.
Absolutely. I mean, the artistry, and what to speak of even insects. I mean, there are insects that are incredibly detailed and beautiful beyond. And even you go, what's really astonishing is when you go to the microscopic world, the world that we can't even perceive. And there you'll also find incredible order, complexity, beauty, you know, individuality. Every grain of sand is different. Every snowflake is different. You have these insects and with these, you know, what do you call it? Shimmering, what do you call it? The word is escaping me. Where the colors are shimmering and reflective, and what's that word?
Iridescent.
Thank you. You have these insects with these iridescent colors, like the peacock's tail, and the fish, also incredibly beautiful fish. And down at the depths of the ocean, in the dark, where no one can see them, you have these, you know, again, incredibly complex, amazing forms that are just perfectly suited for that environment of darkness and extreme pressure. And how it's just the wonders, how each species is exactly suited for their environment, even the variation within the species, you know, the seals or whatever that live in the Arctic. They have special equipment, special physical equipment to deal with the freezing cold water. The camels have, you know, super long eyelashes to keep the sand out of their eyes, and humps to store their water. And there's a book and a video that some devotee scientists made called Nature's IQ, which I really highly recommend. And that is about how we see the glory and the intelligence and the qualities of God within nature. Anybody else?
Yeah, I was saying, even those species that we fall into the category of adiphotic miseries, mm-hmm. like a mosquito, they're brilliant.
Absolutely.
The metamorphic process that they go through, and it's unbelievable how adaptive they are. Or houseflies, pesky as they are, their eye, they can see more than 180 degrees, and they're so adept that some of them even defy the laws of aviation.
Yes, I think the bumblebee is like that. the scientists can't figure out how it flies. How does the heavy body fly with the little wings? You know, I was just reading about this wasp that lays its eggs on orb spiders. And when the eggs hatch, the pupa somehow takes over the brain of the spider. It makes the spider into a slave. And it directs the spider to destroy its sticky prey-catching web and to create its resting web. Then the little larva eats the spider, and it takes the resting web the spider has created and makes a cocoon in it and turns into a whatever it is, butterfly or moth. But it hijacks the nervous system of the spider. I mean, it just... And the scientists don't have a clue as to how it does that. They don't have the slightest idea. They say, well, maybe it's like this, maybe it's like that, maybe it's like this. But they just don't have any idea. I mean, we were reading about mother's milk, that a woman will produce different kinds of milk depending on whether she has a male or a female child. Not sure what happens if she has boy and girl twins. But, you know, the milk is different. And
it's, really?
Yeah. Unbelievable. You know, it's really, really unbelievable. And the composition of the mother's milk also changes as the child gets older. And, the amount of the milk responds to the child. And the mother is not consciously aware of any of this. You know, it's just really amazing, you know, and how each mammal has milk that's specifically suited for their specific kind of creature with the specific nutrients and fat amounts. And, you know, it's just amazing. Oh, something else I was reading. You know, I have all these geckos in my room here in Hawaii, and I was doing some research about geckos. Now, this is really far out, guys. Okay, hold on to your seats, everybody, for this one. We really want to talk about how Krishna fulfills the desires of all living entities. This is going to be a very politically incorrect discussion here, okay? So make sure you put it on the internet and criticize me about it for the next 100 years. But there are some species of life. There's a kind of lizard in Hawaii where there's no males. There's only females. And the females, they engage in some sort of pseudo-copulation, which stimulates them to produce fertilized eggs in their own body, and they give birth to clones. There has not been an instance of the finding of a male of this species ever. And there's evidently a number of species like that. So, you know, if that's what you want, you can get that. You know, there's a species for lesbians, and it's like, wow. Wow, you know, whatever you desire, there's some birth to facilitate that. I was reading that and thinking, that is amazing. You know, and then there's... Then on the other side, there's the seahorses, where the male carries the eggs, and the male gives birth to the eggs and, you know, takes care of the baby. So if that's what, you know, whatever you want, there's some variety of life to fulfill that. You want to, my grandkids were looking at these people using, what are they called? It's like wings, artificial wings. And you can fly off the mountains and glide around, you know. It's like, you really want that. You know, there's all these bird species you can get. And there's some species for every possible conceivable desire and every permutation of that. And why would all these varieties exist if life was just chance, you know? If some amoeba became alive from some chemical shock, why would it have turned into giraffes and geckos? I mean, it's absurd. It's absurd. It would have just gone on being an amoeba. And just to think that there's no divine, loving, amazing. And then, okay, on top of all that, the Vedas tell us that this is the lowest of the middle planets. You know, this is for jivas who just made it into the middle class of the universe. We've just crossed the tracks out of the lower class. And just, you know, can we imagine the variety and the wonder of the species on the higher planets? You know, even in the heavenly planets, they have surabi calves and so forth, and bodies that basically don't age until the last minute, and, you know, magical medical cures, and they can take off their head and put on a goat's head, and the body still works, and all these things. And then what to speak of the spiritual body, the spiritual world, I mean, the wonders of, once we get beyond our everyday earth experience and go to the wonders of the Shastra and the Shastric explanations of the Lord, it becomes completely amazing and mind-boggling. Anyway, sorry I got carried away with that answer. Is there anybody else?
Yeah, Maha Lakshmi Mataji, she has something she wanted to say. And then if you have time, I have one question.
Okay.
Maha Lakshmi?
Well, is that, something that I found surprising is that the demigods ask for guidance to the Lord, and the Lord manifests his gigantic form to them.
Mm.
So I found that it's like matching to the service they have, no?
Yes, yes, exactly. Well, so why is that surprising?
Because they didn't ask for that.
Oh, they didn't ask for that specifically. Yes. Oh, I like your point. In fact, it often works like that with us too, isn't it? That we go to Krishna and we say, Krishna, I have this desire in your service. I'd like to do this in your service. And whatever it may be, you know, I want to start a temple, I want to start a restaurant, I want to publish a book, I want to... And Krishna certainly responds, but he responds with what's best for that, not necessarily what we have in our mind. You know, he'll take us on the right path to reach him. What is it, Ishapanishad? Lead me on the right path to reach you. But it may not be the path that we think. It may be a different path. And it may be a path that to us, we say, well, wait a minute, I asked you for this, why are you giving me that? You know, I wanted to go north and you're taking me east. And he's like, no, this is the best and the fastest way to get there. Okay. So this, again, we're touching on this submission and faith and trust rather than force. It's not, God, you're my servant, and this is what I want to do, and this is how I want to do it. Thank you. Anybody else?
Thank you.
If you have time for one more question.
Yeah.
The verse that you quoted, Sadhu Kavunoi, actually I'm bewildered by it, because sadhana is our path back home, back to Godhead. But it says in that verse, which is so important, Sadhu Kavunoi.
It's so, not by sadhana.
Yeah, so how is it, then why are we practicing sadhana?
Well, it's interesting, because Srila Prabhupada also says that really there is no such practice. He says that directly. He says there is no such practice. It's not really that it's awakened by practice. There is an analogy Prabhupada gave in a lecture that I've heard recently. He said, like, sometimes when a car is stalled, you may push the car, but the car has to start going on its own steam. It's not really pushing the car. It's, you know, you're not trying to push the car all the way to its destination. You're pushing the car just to give it a little bit of a start. So also, it's not a practice in the sense that it's not artificial. And the example always given is that a child has walking, and a normal healthy child has walking innately within its body. It's intrinsic to the body. So a normal healthy child at birth, immediately after birth, if you hold up the child, they will put their feet on a surface, they will automatically, instinctually put one foot in front of another. It's one of the tests done to see if a baby is healthy. It's part of what's called the Apgar score. So walking is innate within the child. And although children do practice walking, it's not exactly that the practice creates the walking. The practice reveals the walking that's already innate within the child. or, you know, a human child has language also innately within them. Now, if you just keep a child in a closet, like some, you know, poor children have been brought up in a closet, or they've been brought up by animals, then that innate language doesn't manifest. It's there, but it doesn't manifest. However, if you put a child around other humans, the talking will eventually manifest. And again, it's not exactly that the practice creates it. The language capacity is within the child. Because if you take an animal and put them around people, the talking capacity never manifests. You could say, well, it does with parrots, but they're not really talking. You know, they're not really engaging in anything that would be called conversation. And we could contrast this to something artificial. Like, let's take ballet dancing. So ballet dancing is not an intrinsic ability of a human body. A human body is not designed to walk around on the tips of its toes. That's not how the body is designed. And in fact, ballerinas end up having all kinds of problems with their legs and feet from doing a lot of toe dancing. So you can learn how to do toe dancing by practice. You can practice and practice and practice and practice and practice until you are able to do it. But it's not, it's something that's created by practice. It's not something that's brought out by a situation. It's actually created by practice. Or a similar example with feet, you know, women who wear high heel shoes. So when you first put on a pair of high heel shoes, you just fall. And by practice, 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 you can learn how to walk in high heel shoes, but it damages the body. So it is possible by practice to do something artificial, but then there are negative results. And bhakti is not like that. Bhakti isn't something artificial that you force yourself to do by practice. It's not like that. It's basically that if you put yourself in your natural environment and you start doing the things that are natural to the soul, then those things that are already there start coming out of their own accord. It's really more like that, like the same concept of a seed. If you just keep a seed lying around, nothing will happen. But if you give the seed water and sunlight and warmth, light, water, then if you put it in that environment, the natural, inherent, innate attributes of the seed manifest. So our sadhana, really, what it really is, our practice, is not really exactly something that we are doing. It's not like we're the doer and the controller and we're doing something to force ourselves into an unnatural position. Krishna says, what can repression accomplish? It's just useless. However, what we are doing is we are willfully, consciously, intentionally putting ourselves into a situation with activities, with people, with food, with sounds that are our natural state. They correspond to our natural state. They're in harmony with our natural state. And as we're in that environment, our natural state starts to manifest. And after a while, we're no longer dependent on that environment. We still seek it out because we love it, but we're not dependent on it. In the beginning, without being in that conducive environment, nothing is going to happen. You know, like the tiny seed, without being in the conducive environment, it's not going to sprout. But a very mature plant can go for a long time, even without water and so forth. So the mature devotee, just like Srila Prabhupada, he came to America without any of those supports at all. You know, he didn't have anything. Didn't have any external sangha. He created the sangha, you know. He didn't have any of those things, and it was irrelevant for him. He was fully manifested within himself. And Srila Prabhupada engaged in chanting not as a practice, but because he loved it out of spontaneous love. So when that starts to happen, when one starts to chant and offer one's food out of spontaneous love, then one no longer needs the support of some sort of rule. you know, it doesn't have to be, well, I'm chanting my rounds because there's a rule and I made a vow. It's like, well, of course I'm going to chant my rounds. I love to chant my rounds. But this Prabhupada says when 16 rounds isn't enough, when you want to chant 16,000 rounds, that is the quality. Anyway, so it's not a practice in the sense of forcing through practice something that is alien to us. It's not that kind of a practice. Is that clear?
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Crystal clear. Thank you. Never heard a better explanation.
Well, I'm just repeating what Prabhupada says. Okay, we could have time for one more. We could have time for one more if anyone else has any other question or comment.
Okay, since nobody's jumping into that, I would like to hear this class again. I'd like to actually hear you give this class again for some people here up at Eden Rock. I already know I've got some new people. But transcripts of some talks that Shinamarsh had with some with PhDs, with Srup Damodar and some other educated men. And in one point he says there's no conception of anything without consciousness, and that all undesirable things are only a mental concoction. And so there's a point where he says that actually the Lord, according to our desires, he gives us the vision to see things. And if we change our desire, if we want to see him, or we want to, you know, develop, as you were saying in the class, our spiritual consciousness, then it will develop accordingly.
Right.
So it's a subjective thing, consciousness. It's not, you know, sometimes we think it's objective, but it's subjective.
Yes. Yes, by its very nature. In fact, what you said just now, I mean, we've pretty much run out of time, but what you said just now is my understanding of the reason why God appears differently to different persons. In fact, today's verse, where Vijñapitam, as he was prayed for, he was responding to their specific prayers, and Lord Kapila says, the Lord appears in the form in which we worship him, that our understanding of Krishna will always be subjective. We think in this world that the problems in this world are due to subjectivity. We think the problems are due to individuality. And if everybody could just see things the same way, which usually means my way, then we'd all be happy. You know, there was even a Beatles song like that. If you could just see it my way, then everything would work out. And as long as you see it your way, it's going to be a catastrophe. And this is our general mentality, that the way I perceive things is the truth, and the way everyone else perceives things is wrong. And we put this idea even onto spiritual things and religious things, and you know, my version of Islam is the truth and your version of Islam is a lie, bang bang, you know. And this kind of thing goes on, but this sort of mentality is really thinking of God impersonally, because only impersonal things and only things are perceived objectively by everyone in the same way. So if we're going to talk about a thing, if we're going to look at a table and ask everyone to get out rulers and scales and describe the table, we can reach a fully agreed upon description of that table even by millions of people, and where nobody will have a difference of opinion, even to the minutest degree. But when we're talking about something that is spirit, such a consensus is impossible. It's just impossible. As soon as you talk about anything that is alive, and the more developed in consciousness that being is, the more disparate the descriptions of it will be. So if I ask everyone to describe a plant, well, we might come to almost similarity. But if we ask you to describe a dog, it becomes that much more difficult. And what to speak of a human being? A human being is so complex and changing and unfolding and so forth, right? That how is everyone going to describe them the same way? And sometimes we become puzzled by that. I mean, I had an instance many years ago where I was dealing with a particular person, a devotee, who I found impossible to deal with. Just, I didn't have a good adjective to describe this person. I couldn't think of any. And it was so bad that I would avoid this person even physically. I'd walk to another place. I would do everything I could to avoid this person. And it was interesting because we didn't work together, anything. I didn't know why this person had so much animosity towards me. And then after some time, one of my very, very good friends, and a devotee I highly, highly respect, I found out was very good friends with this person. And I thought, well, if this friend of mine can see good in this person, there must be some good there, although I can't see it. And I started adjusting my vision of this person, and now we happen to be quite close friends, and we've worked together on many projects, and sometimes we say how unbelievable it is that we went from being complete antagonists to very good friends. And really what happened was that my vision of this person and another person's vision of this person were so opposite that it gave me pause and thought that, you know, there must be something I'm not seeing. But we have this kind of experience all the time. You know, that you'll describe a person, no, that's not, they're not like that. That's not my experience with them at all. They're nothing like that. And how is that possible? You know, of all the people who know me, of all the people who know each of us, they all have different views of us. And the qualities in me or in each of us that one person loves, that very quality another person may despise. And such is the nature of personality and consciousness. It is subjective. So each perfected devotee sees the Lord somewhat differently. Why are there even unlimitedly different spiritual realms? There's an unlimited number of Vaikuntha planets. Why isn't there just one big planet? You ever ask that question? Why are there unlimited Vaikuntha planets? Why are there so many realms within Goloka Vrindavan? You know, the Acharyas explained that there's a realm within Goloka Vrindavan where the Krishna is married to the gopis and they're in opulence. Why are there different rasas? Why are there so many varieties within the rasas? Because we're each individual, and therefore our view of reality is subjective. You know, one person is going to see Krishna as a little boy, and another person is going to see him as a handsome young man. And this is, some are going to be really noticing his quality of chivalry, and another his gentleness. Some are going to be attracted to his dear Lalita, some to his dear Gata. So their descriptions of Krishna are going to be different. And this doesn't mean that, you know, as long as it's all within the scripture, it doesn't mean that one is right and one is wrong. Prabhupada said these differences of opinion are evidence of personality. As one devotee wrote to Prabhupada, there's differences of opinion due to impersonalism. Prabhupada said, no, it's due to personalism. He says, as long as we don't have a different opinion about the basic process, then we should accept that there's not going to be, Prabhupada said, any kind of utopia. And would we want that? Would we want a utopia where everybody agrees about everything all the time? You know, that's the Brahmajyoti. That also exists. Just see the amazing nature of God. If you want objective truth, if you want the absolute truth as objective, not subjective, and you want 100% harmony of opinion and experience, the Brahmajyoti is there for you. There you can be like that. No individuality, no differences of opinion, no differences of perception. With just an objective description of the absolute truth, without form, without qualities, without personality. even that option exists. So such is the amazing, incredible variety of the Lord and the reciprocation in a very subjective and personal way. Now, our material subjectivity is painful because we each have ourself as the center. It's not the subjectivity itself that's painful. It's the fact that my subjective opinion is meant to position myself above everybody else. And everyone else's subjective opinion is meant to position themselves above everybody else. And therefore, it's extremely painful. But if you have unlimited subjective opinions that are all meant to position Krishna above everybody else, then it's simply a beautiful variety rather than painful. So I think I need to stop here. Thank you very much. You will probably be